The title listed out there is You've Come a Long Way, Baby. And obviously, those of you who study the TV commercials understand that it's really the Virginia Slims that have come a long way in the tennis world. But I think it's a pretty good slogan. But the second part of it, which we didn't quite get in the title, is You've Come a Long Way, Baby, and You've Got a Long Way to Go. And it's really the way to go that's of primary concern. But as a student of history, I always feel like it helps if we understand what's come before in order to know what were some of the problems that arose in order to deal with the present. The focus of attention is on American women in American society, the past, the present, and the future. To start with, I think my own case may be a case study in some ways, and so I'd like to start with it. And to keep it shorter, I've written the first part down. I'm a female. I'm a product of my culture. And this has prevented me from entering into many arenas of the world. The primary arena that concerned me originally was the sport world, which was denied me. But now there are a thousand things open to us, I think. I've been deprived in some ways of the freedom to marry, in that I was interested in a professional life, and family and marriage and professional life rarely went together, and certainly not in the middle class of which I was raised. That, I think, is in the background. If I were 20 years younger, I think I could find a male in our society who would be willing for me to be professional, perhaps to have a family, and to be married, and that we could work cooperatively. But at the same time, I am aggressive, competitive, and competent, physically strong, and movement is my favorite activity. I'm relatively bright, vigorous, I think for myself, and heaven forbid, sometimes I'm even logical. I, as a female, have male traits, and I have competencies which are difficult or have been difficult to possess in our society. And to add to that, I'm a physical educator, having moved into the masculine world of masculinity being proven through athletic events. And so the task that I put before myself, before I even knew it, was terribly difficult. But I think where we have come a long way is that I am now free to be single, I am free to be female, to be a female athlete even, and that affirmative action has helped in a legislative sense. And if Paul Hayne is right in some of his comments on the law, that the law is a catalyst and does help determine what the course of events have been. And legislation is perhaps the single most important event that has happened for women. My first realization that there was something different between male and female was not until the age of 9, which I think is relatively unusual. Someplace between 7 and 9, and my brother and I were playing hospital. And in the process, I, of course, wanted to be the surgeon to do all the cutting into the doll. And I was informed in the very best masculine way possible, but you can't be a doctor. And this went on and on, and I remember his final triumph, because with my why, only males and men and boys are doctors. Not girls. And my first shock, a realization that I just simply couldn't do everything I want. The second, probably most devastating to my being, was about 13 when I was playing a little game called touch football, and I was on a punt, and the punt went astray into the neighbor's window. I really was generally a pretty good punter. But I was going to be great. My brother punted with his left foot, so I was going to punt with my left foot. And my left foot went into and near the left window of the neighbor's. And the neighbor came over to inform my mother that I was a girl. And consequently, that I really ought to be kept in the house to learn those domesticated kinds of things. And so I learned of the double standards of women. Fortunately, I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to think. Nobody told me that for a long time. And so I think I was raised in a little different culture in some ways than any other. But as we view the whole problem of women in society, I think our primary concern, even as I begin to talk about it, is that the focus of attention ought to be on women as human beings first and as women second. And once we have really grasped the significance of human beingness first, as Dorothy Sayers in her book on Are Women Human, I think, really makes clear, and a good commentary on it, makes some things look so ludicrous that we realize the discriminatory kinds of things that have happened. And it's in answering the question of who are you, I am a human being, I think that has helped us to move a long way. Because when you look at male and femaleness, as I perceive it, there are probably only a few distinguishing factors that we can prove by scientific evidence. One is that the woman does, in fact, produce and carry the child after being conceived by a male and a female. And then all the sexual differences that result from that are really only significant in about three ways. One, we have more fatty deposit. We will and we shall and we do, unless we take male hormones. And so fatty tissue is a fight for all women, and particularly women perhaps over 40, that may not be for the men. But they're less dangerous to us physiologically to be a little heavier, by the way, because it's your husband that's going to die of the heart attack more than you. Until, of course, you move into the professional world, and then, by the way, you're starting to die early, too, as a result of being in our competitive society. The other two ways that we differ is in strength and in speed, and that is only on the average and therefore the very top levels. Otherwise, there is only cultural truths about how we differ. The whole aggressive world, that we're passive, that we're weak, that we're emotionally unstable, and all of these are cultural kinds of learnings, as we can find in other societies traits that do not demonstrate this. And I think that's important to keep in mind as we're talking about women in society, that we are not psychologically different except as our culture has made us so, which makes it terribly important, of course, for your children and for the children that we're going to educate. I think that society has changed, can be seen even here at Holden, and as I present these, I generally will be giving the negatives and the positives together in a sequence. Primary, I think, in and of importance to us is the fact that we have a woman pastor who is responsible for the ministry at Holden Village. The second is that we do have women faculty members giving vespers, participating in the program. We have women on the Maverick crew. We have a couple men in Narnia. We have much more equalization on the volleyball court, with near half, most often, being women and having their place not only as a setter but as a spiker. And that is strictly a last 4-year accomplishment at Holden Village. At the same time, however, that we're looking at the positives, we can look at the fact we have no woman on an administrative level at Holden Village. We have lots of secretaries on the middle management or lower management level. We have one woman on the trustee group, plus one woman as the token woman on the board. We have had perhaps one woman here under her own right as a husband-wife combination, and not because she happens to be also good, but her husband is the primary individual that has been invited to the village, and perhaps two or three women who have been invited because of themselves as a professional or as a member. We have only women on the housekeeping crew. We have only women waitresses. We have all but perhaps one woman in the laundry, and have had, we have all but one woman and perhaps no women in the snack bar. And the primary decisions are probably made at Holden Village by men. And this is a small cosmic of perhaps the real society. In our church society, I think we find a lot of the same kinds of things. Our women can serve on boards, as long as there's not too many of them and they know how to write. They can perhaps be treasures of it. They can also teach your young children in a Sunday school, but they can't teach the confirmation class. They can take care of the domesticated kinds of things, and the males often make the decisions. But these kinds of things, I think, are changing as our society changes. And certainly since 1792, when the first woman's book came out by Mary Wollstonecraft on a vindication of the rights of women, I think progress has been made. The first women in 1821 started the secondary schools, Oberlin College permitting women into their colleges, the first women's rights convention, 1848. And during the Civil War, it is women who were against slavery far more than men. Over half of the petitions signed against slavery in the Congress were signed by women, as evidence of political power that we had and that we probably haven't used in a large sense since that time. The 13th and 14th Amendment, however, women gave up their rights to this in order to be sure that the blacks had rights. And so male was used both in the 13th and 14th Amendment, although the Equal Protection of the Law Amendment now also includes women and is primarily used rather than the Equal Rights Amendment, which hasn't been passed. In the early suffrage movements, I think they're significant only because there were two groups of women's suffrage, a national women's group, which only had to do with law, and another women's suffrage group, which had to do with the broader social implications besides the law. And I think that's what becomes significant to us in the 1960s, that within the women's movement, there also have been two groups, a legislative group called WEAL and a social implication group called NOW. I think, as you all know from your readings, or perhaps know, the NOW group has been the most instrumental in a positive and a negative sense, and that they have split in half, and they have the separatist group and the NOW general group, the National Organization for Women. But they have had an important function in society in the Equal Rights Amendment and in the concept of freedom for women as human beings, both in legal and in the non-legal sense. And so they probably have been the most significant to us. Also, the Women's Commission on the Status of Women on the national level has been significant for us. The American Association of the University Women, the Women League, or the League of Women Voters, and the Women's Coalition on the national level, which is recognized by our new president as an important influential group, has been significant in legislative matters. Finally, the law that's been important to us is the Civil Rights Act, or Title VII, which is equal opportunity in employment, and now Title IX of the Educational Amendment Act has been terribly significant. And then within legal terms, the right of abortion, Social Security, the Women's Equity Acts, Higher Education Acts have all been significant in how we got where we are, and therefore has been significant to us in it. So I think that's the setting of where we are, and as I perceive it then, some of the things that are important is in the educational world, what is happening and what we need to do. And on these, I think I'll talk about each one and then we'll discuss it and then go on. I'm interested in education, in employment, in the church, and then some of the issues that are being faced. I think education is the single most important area to attack besides the family. That certainly you people, as family people, have the number one job, because you determine how children are going to be treated as human beings, or if they're going to be treated as male and as female in terms of human beings. But as soon as they go into school, we therefore start the categorization The textbooks, the curriculum, all of these affect what happens. Education has probably been the most general way in which women have had employment in a professional sense. If you look at everything we've done professionally, it is education that we've had a place. But what happens, how many principals are women in your secondary schools that any of you live? Zero. One. And yet you look at the base of numbers because principals come out of education. And what's the number one thing that they've already been before they become principal? Boy jocks. Number one has been coaches, which gives a complete, if any of you are in athletics, as I am, you'll know that if there can't be a worse place besides theology, perhaps, in which the males have completely dominated it in order to survive. And so the coach becomes the principal, and that's one of the difficulties. How about elementary school, though? How many women principals? Okay, there may be five or six that have had women principals. But ironically now, as the males go into elementary physical education, guess where they're going next? Principal of the elementary school, because we've got to have a male model for those little fourth, fifth, and sixth grade boys. And I wonder, what's happening to the model for the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade girls? This is one of the places they have seen women in a position of authority or decision-making. And decision-making, of course, can only be decision-making if they have part of the budget. And so the budget, the purse strings really become the significant factor of whether women have control or they don't. In a marriage, if the woman has no control of the purse strings, she's not equal, no matter how you hack it, if they don't have some kinds of equality. In athletics, where the women are given token monies and they don't have help to make decisions. In business, if the women can be great and glorious in business but have no control or power within this, there becomes some kinds of difficulty. Textbooks is one of the primary things that we're looking at now. I reviewed 28 elementary books for grades 1 through 6. Guess how many pictures of girls, and I was interested in sport, because sport is one of the ways it's so visible that we've had difficulties. Guess how many girls playing in these particular 28? One. And this girl was holding the bat like this. In the picture. One. One picture of a girl playing baseball with her brothers. Every other picture in this 1 through 6 grade book had to do with boys in soccer, boys in baseball, boys in cutting the grass. Guess what the girls were doing?
Watching.
Watching was their primary aim in sport. What were they doing in other areas?
Playing dolls.
They were playing with their dolls, occasionally a hopscotch game, but never showing them actually doing it, but in the writings of it. They're also playing house. They're also gossiping in a little corner. They've got little furniture and these kinds of things. And that's one of the things that's happening in society, is that stereotyping is being removed. The curriculum is including sewing for the boys in all these kinds of areas. There are projects, too, on trying to educate women for reentry in education, which I think is probably one of the important areas that you ought to be looking into if you're interested in combining rearing a family, part-time work, part-time education, and having any kind of access to recreating your own way of life that includes some kinds of training. There are $200,000 of Women's Equity Act, up to $6 million that's being spent on educating women. A lot of minority group women, but also women, particularly non-high school graduates, and a few leadership training programs. And wherever your local colleges are, or your local NOW or WHEEL organizations, you can find out information about it for career reorientation, and particularly for mothers getting back in. Also, corporations are having programs in which they're re-entering women in an educational sense. PEER, Project on Equal Education Rights, is also spending money. There are also local towns that are getting $15,000 to $200,000 grants, which can give you access into these. Also, probably terribly important to us are children's centers being supported by campuses, being supported by the government. Many of you may be against children's centers, but they permit an opportunity for women to see if they want to work, to see if they want to get into the workaday world. Right now, 57% of the women are working who are married, and almost 100% of the divorced women are in the working force, and we as women make up about 33% of the entire workforce. We probably make up less than 2% of the administrative force, however, in any sense. In education, on the collegiate level, we make up 22% of faculty on junior college and up level, but of that 22% in the total program, only 5% of that 22%. In other words, then making it 100%, 100 of us are in it, of the women, then only 5 are full professors, for example. So that there is a lot of sort of ways to go in it, and you can do that on the middle management level too. So what I'd like to do now is have any comments or questions or whatever on in the area of education that you might be interested in or that you have noted as positives or negatives in the education world.
One thing I discovered going to the seminary for in terms of that kind of education was that learning that men and women really do things differently in terms of thought processes, although we may, when we go into a particularly male-dominated area, make an attempt to adapt normal female thought processes that society has given us, namely the more intuitive, inductive kind of working from the inside out instead of the outside in, and try to adapt to the mammals. That doesn't work very well, and a lot of times at the seminary, these poor teachers giving, you know, trying to get used to having this woman here, but a lot of times they would say, "This is a wonderful paper, but how did you get there?" And that happened to women all the time, you know, and once you could sit down and explain the process, it worked. That might be more true of theology than of other fields, but maybe not, but it's sometimes it's very funny. Sometimes it got you in trouble.
Yeah, I think there's no question that culturally, some way or other, our thinking processes do differ. They automatically tell us when we're 7 that they don't expect us to know math, that they don't expect us to take logic, that it's not a part of our being. And I really found difficulty, not on my master's level, because I ended up at a school almost by chance that was all women, which had some of the advantages of teaching leadership and role models that were great for me. But when I went to work on my doctorate, I found it very difficult to adapt to the way the men thought, plus the whole locker room system that they had up and down the area. It's incredible to me the kind of buddy system that they have, which then is perpetuated in all kinds of graduate school. And I think all of you might find some of those kinds of problems where you don't even know that you think differently. You know, the biggest compliment in the world from a male is you think like a man. And what it really is in their sense, is an adaptation of theirs, a copying, in a sense, because that's the model that we have. The biggest illustration of that is athletics. You know, we've got 1,000 great things in women's athletics, and we're just prancing right over to the commercialization and all of the crud and corruption that the male had, because we've got those split women groups who, one, I don't care whether it's right or good or just, if the men have it, I want it, as opposed to bringing the two together, taking the best from both worlds, which we're just on the brink of maybe being able to do.
You touched on something, Joanne, that I wanted to ask about, and that's like an all-women's college or all kinds of things that are just for women. I grew up in an all-female family. That kind of thing, whether you think that's a plus or a minus, the sort of separation of...
I think probably now it's a minus in some ways, but a lot of women, and particularly in the women's movements, feel that we have to separate before we can unite, a little like the blacks. that separation was essential. I don't know, the leadership role that is allowed to take in a woman's college gives you a confidence, an identity that's pretty tough in the male world. It's interesting because our National Collegiate Women's Association, all physical education women on the college level have an organization, and the men have an organization. And we have combined in publications in all sorts of ways. But this year we had a vote on 1,400 women, and we had to have two-thirds, and could not get two-thirds of the women physical educators to vote to unite with the men. And the reason given was that we needed it for support system, and that it should stay separate for another 5 years. I find it very difficult because I think our graduate women are being handicapped by belonging to a women's group and giving presentations only in a women's group, where they are great thinkers in some of the humanistic views, and the men are sitting over there in their ivory towers being superior, not even knowing what we have to contribute. So I don't know. Any of the rest of you know what you think in that sort of system?
I'm in a science and have found it's essential for me to have, I'm in nutrition, which is basically probably women mainly, but I have to have the contact with the very male-dominated fields in chemistry, and I think I would have to have that to survive and do well in my field. You know, whereas I think if I stayed within my department, within a mainly female-oriented program, I would not have some of the ability to cope in the other field, you know, to get along well, to advance myself as I would like to in my field.
Anybody else in that or other educational kinds of? Yeah.
Here's one thing. I don't know how this works in other states, but I work for a health and recreation division, and it's a very large one. It's interesting to note that within that particular district, there are maybe four professional women who have jobs within the social service area. I'm one of them, and it took me 7 years. I think as we see parks and recreations becoming a more integral part of our society, with more leisure time and more areas being turned over to park and recreation divisions or whatever, that I did note that when I first started out 7 years ago, there were probably 10 men to one woman. 7 years later, it's decreased, but oddly enough, not in the board of directors, not in an advisory board capacity, and not in an administration capacity. And I don't know if anybody else is aware of what goes on in your parks and recreation division, if you even have one wherever it is that you live. But it's a struggle uphill. Really, it's difficult at best. And it may, you know, the concept that they have when it was brought up to the board of directors is that by the very essence of park and recreation, women can be the recreation leader. They can teach the new nursery school. If you have a master's degree, you can still create a program within a program, but you're still at that particular level. And we're talking about a team force of about 250. And of those, 37 are female and all the rest are male.
Government is another example. If we can, I think, move on into employment, which is also a part of education in a sense. I was on the Coalition for Women on Carter's asking for suggestions of women. And the WEAL, which is the Women's Equity Action League, was asked, as was physical education, and I think all of the NEA, National Education Association groups, to submit names of women for top level governmental positions. And we got together so they would all be the same, submitted 9 names for all of the cabinet. And all of them were looked at as five finalists in it. None of them were accepted based on lack of experience. In women's athletics, we had 92% of the athletic departments were run by women in 1971 when we moved into our national organization for national athletics. In 1976, 77, this year, there are now 58% of the athletic departments in which women participate which have women leaders. And in sending out the reason, they almost all of them will have a woman in the five finalists in the smaller schools. In the larger schools, they don't even have a woman. And experience is given as the reason. And yet women have been ably running physical education departments, but we don't know budget. And so it's very difficult to sort of catch up. And these are the kinds of things that federal grants are trying to do and take affirmative action in middle management. And that's where it's tough, you know, to get that next step. We're getting pretty good on these bottom steps. Equal pay in factories is fine. Equal pay in the blue collar, if you get in it, is fine. But as you get higher and higher in the white collar, it gets more and more difficult in terms of the employment kinds of things. And it takes one more degree than it takes for men. If you have a master's degree, there are certain things you now can do that the men can do with an undergraduate degree. If you have a PhD, there's some things now that you can do that master candidates could do in the whole workaday world. But as I see it, employment, one of the big problems is in the area of married women and their concept of their primary role. If they really perceive their primary role as home, then it does become pretty difficult for management to see their primary role as being a worker. So if a married woman's real dedication is to the home, it's the same difficulty if the man says when he's asked in an interview, is your primary concern, is your family, they don't say it this way. But what it comes out is your family number one or is this profession at least close to number one? And if he answers family, he's trained not to. But the woman almost automatically comes out with number one is the family and only secondary some kinds of profession. And that I think one of the things we need to think about is, can we say they're equal and really still be able to raise the family well, rear the family, carry on, do all of the kinds of duties that one has? And I think that's one of the questions in employment that you have to struggle with, is where you are. Do you understand what I'm saying, or have any reaction to that sort of thing in the employment world? Or do we see it as supplementing the family income sort of period?
Well, can a woman, though, if they have, say, for instance, small children, you know, under the ages, can they give this total dedication to a profession? Or is there a guilt complex if you do because your youngsters are, you know, if somebody's sick, it's awfully hard to go to work and have that be your top priority when you know that this child is really maybe, you know, not maybe physically needing you because someone else can minister to those, but maybe, you know, an attachment, like a child says, Mom, please don't go to work today. You know, because I want you here. He doesn't know why he wants you there, but he or she wants you there.
Anybody want to react?
Is this for the guilt?
Well, I think part of that is the fault of the mother herself. Why wouldn't the child ask his father to stay home from work?
And my he used to scream and howl when I had to go to work, and I don't know if he felt guilty. I mean, it was reality. The child had just had to, you know, he would come home at noon for lunch or whatever and go, and, you know, the child had to learn. Now he doesn't, of course, that this was just something that happened. And if a woman does that, the child also could learn this is something that happens, we still love you.
Can a man give total dedication to his profession when he's got a family at home that wants him there?
It's probably the same. It's the double standard again.
I don't think he thinks in terms.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he does either. He's not asked that question.
He's not. But if we ask the question, can we ask the question to the woman too? Or is it an illegal question?
It's an illegal question.
You
ask it anyway.
Yeah, right.
But in this situation,
such dedication to any career,
which is a part of the same question. So you take the word total out and put commitment to two or three things, and can we deal with it?
Yeah, you have to have priorities. I mean, I would think that that question would be, you know, I'm not a working mother, so I don't know. You know, there's no problem. But if I was, I would think that problem would have to be dealt by either father or mother. One of us would stay home with our child, because that child is more important than any job, really, or profession. At least I see that. And it would be a matter of one of us, if we even had to lose a day of pay, because that child is more important, the value is there. But, you know, I agree there shouldn't be a double standard.
Seems to me everyone's answer should be, hopefully, ideally, yes, the family is number one, man or female. But that doesn't mean my career is something I enjoy. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm a homemaker. But, you know, it seems to me that a man should say, yes, my family's number one, and it doesn't mean that his job is less important than how he feels about it.
What I'm saying is that the employer, you know, I think feels rightfully cheated sometimes because there is this factor. You know, I mean, I'm not a working mother either. I've been, you know, done some things, but I mean, I think that this is probably where the problem comes. I mean, they want you there when they want you there, and I mean, they have a right to expect you to give your fullest to whatever.
Yeah, but you're making it sound as if the other, you know, that there's perfection. What about the work days that are lost due to alcoholism by men? Well, I bet they would be far in excess of a woman staying
single
home
women.
To take child.
Especially.
Yeah. No, this isn't an education, Joanne, but I've been wondering about it. Two things. One is, why is the ERA bill having such a problem? I think we just finished killing it in Oklahoma. We passed Laetrile, but we killed ERA. The other thing is, why is it that I have heard so little about the inequity of a man and wife owning and operating a business, which happens all over the United States today, you know, from bait shops on lakes to restaurants and so on, and yet the wife, it is not legal for the husband to pay the wife a salary. Therefore, he cannot declare Social Security for her, cannot pay into it. Therefore, she can work all of her life side by side with her husband, doing the same work, and not be eligible to have the benefits of Social Security. And well, I hear very little about it.
Right now, the Social Security Act has just been changed so that your husband can take out Social Security, and you can be equal partners in a corporation, in business, split the same way as any relative can do, which is a 1975-76 if you get your lawyers on it.
Well, now you could always be part of a corporation.
And you just put your name as part of the corporation.
But part of a business, if you do not incorporate.
Yeah, right.
It's very expensive to incorporate.
$400.
But the funny thing is, you can work for your son and be paid. You can't work for your husband and be paid.
And the first one was, what was the first question?
ERA.
The ERA.
Oh, ERA. I think the ERA is the very basic issue that we have to struggle with here, which has to do with the whole family setting, the marriage setting, the kinds of total commitments. I don't mean total commitment in work, but total commitment that a family makes in how they're going to function. And the fear factor. It's a terrible fear that a married woman can experience when she's never had to think about anything except, as soon as I have that husband, then my worries are finished. While under the ERA, where there's all kinds of equality, the whole problem of male-femaleness is involved. then the guilt complexes come, and as long as the law keeps them free, then they are freer under the bounds and the boundaries. It's really pretty scary to be free to think about, what do I want to become besides a wife and a mother? And so I think it's the biases, the physiological biases, the prejudices and the myths and the family concept of our society that has interfered with the Equal Rights Amendment. And that it's the Equal Rights Amendment, I think, is not significant to me. I think the 14th Amendment can do the same thing. Title IX of the Educational Amendment Act can do it, and the grievances are cheaper. I can file a grievance for free under Title IX, and that's going to affect almost every school except Brigham Young. And the 14th Amendment is male-femaleness, and we can take a class action suit on it. But the principle behind why it's not passed is scary. In terms of the fears, and we have put the fears in by that we're going to make toilets together, or we're going to make music together, or whatever. And so I think the concept is almost like in the church concept of tradition, and some kind of fear that I will lose my self-identity if it's involved only in femaleness. And in the book on our bodies, it really helps in understanding the concept of my body as mine, as an independent sort of thing. And it's a dependent factor, I think, on the female's part. But there's also the male part that has interfered with the Equal Rights Amendment, but they just don't preach about it. They just vote against it. The women who are against it are moving out. But I think the males are afraid of the female, and certainly they're afraid of the female mind and jobs. If I'm as good as 20 of my colleagues, and I now have a chance to advance, they no longer see me as kind of an equal, because there was no chance of me being, for example, a full professor in years past. Now I find these men pitting themselves against the concept. And I think maybe that's one of the problems, is the male, and that therefore how we have come a long way is almost legally, as opposed to ourselves. And I think the statement that helps most is, it's hard to fight an enemy who has an outpost in your head. And that is kind of one of the... Anybody else want to react to that? Because I think it's one of the basic problems. Nancy?
Just one thing about just legislation generally. I'm not... The ERA, sort of wishy-washy, why bother to some extent. But, you know, it's interesting, the issues that we have to do. But just legislation generally, part of the problem with that is that it disallows the diversity of the male and the female. In terms of legislating, I mean, it's important to have, I can't even say this properly, but it's important to have, you know, equal opportunities for people who have not had them in the past. But just for an example, a couple years ago, I guess, how long has Title IX been in operation? A year and a half, 2 years?
1972, but functionally operating 1975.
Yeah. But there was one case in Ohio, in a church, over a church choir, a boys' choir, and some parents wanted their little girls to sing in this choir, and it was quite a prestigious one, and they took it to court under Title IX. Well, to my mind, that's just crazy, because it just happens to be a fact of life that small boys, before their voices change, have a particular voice quality that makes particularly nice music. Small girls do not have that particular quality, and so that's just insane. But a law, you know, legislation then allows for that kind of lack of really affirming our diversity.
Yeah, but there's one in the federal courts. There's rational justification for sex classification, by which, if it's not a fundamental right, and the right to be in a choir is not fundamental, mm-hmm. So every circuit court would undoubtedly use rational justification. But in some things where it's a basic right to a job, then it's more difficult. Like there's a bona fide employment quote in equal employment, which says it's a dumb standard. But the standard is, if there's more than 50 pounds of lifting, they can keep a woman from being in a certain employment. Well, we finally have demonstrated through research that on the average, a woman may not be able to lift 50 pounds, but why not test her for what it is she can lift? And then whatever the standard of that woman is, if she can't lift 100 pounds and the job takes 100 pounds, male or female, she ought not to get the job. And so there has been some protection that hasn't been a protection because of this bona fide. The problem with the Equal Rights Amendment is whether they will or they won't use as a standard rational justification for sex classification. And if they don't, then I think we are in some kinds of trouble. And that's why the ERA doesn't bother me. But that's not why most people aren't doing the ERA, and therefore it bothers me.
Carol? What state was that in? I think it was Ohio. Because I read another article about...
they have an equal rights amendment there.
Some school system has actually abolished the boys' choir and the girls' choir, which is, you know, that kind of thing could really run into all kinds of trouble if it's in the music field. Say, well, you can no longer have a string quartets because timpani's one very short at a time or something. It's so stupid to try and argue those.
In the federal, all the federal courts that have had cases in which there was rational justification, one of which was, I think it was a choir group in the Washington, D.C., was given that kinds of things. But I think one of the things is the self-identity crisis and having to reshape priorities. So maybe husband's priority becomes that in his job he's off from 8 till 11. I think probably one of the best positives that's come from this whole women's liberation or whatever is that there's both mothers and fathers over there at Doris Edmonds' session on children. And I have found it in a lot of places where fathers now know when their kid walked, the moment he walked, and is vitally interested in the rearing of children. And with this new kind of activity, I think there's a lot of fathers that will organize the same as for mothers in employment that has to do with staying home when the child is sick, as opposed to the mother. A lot of things are happening where two are taking the job of a full time, for example, for women who want to work, which I think is kind of a compromise measure, that I want to work, but I don't want to work all the time. And that two people, they get really almost twice as much energy out of as one. And certainly on the collegiate level, they are doing this, industry is trying. So that Sarah can work half-time if she wants to, and Jean can work half-time. Maybe Al can work half-time, and Jim can work half-time. And then you can easily have kinds of family rearing in it. But one of our problems in society is that work identifies men. And so when you begin to deal with women, and it doesn't identify, then we put them in a whole big class of 50%. Which is house or homemakers, where some of them may have homemaking as their identity. They really love it, and they're really good at it. I think Carol Lehman is one. Seven children, and she loves it. And when she doesn't have a baby, then they go running around getting foster children. That is absolutely something she loves. And that is a kind of a way of life and that sort of thing. What other kinds of problems quickly do you see, or positive steps that have been taken, or steps that you see as things that ought to be taken in looking at women as human beings, sort of primarily, and then diversify?
Well, a lot of, you know, especially when a company has government contracts and they have to abide by federal law in employment and so on, many times, women and blacks are being given jobs in which they're not competent, simply to fill the quotas. And this is making the men who have to work with them and even under them very, very angry.
What you really need to be is minority woman writing your dissertation on Jews or Indians and a PhD, and it doesn't matter your competency in it. I think it happens in the black, and I certainly think it happens in the women, and more in government. I have seen more women in government that are pretty poor than almost any place. Mm-hmm. And it is that whole government grant.
Yeah.
Carol?
One of the problems that's recently come up in Los Angeles is that there's been an attempt to get the first female in the fire department in Los Angeles, and it's been a very slow process of integrating the fire department anyway, and now they're trying to get a woman in. Gal has been working for, I don't know, 7 years in training for the fire department. She just passed the test, and she was, she was about eighth on the list for the raw scores. Then they added to the scores of the men their service record. And so she, you know, so they give points for military service.
10 points.
Yeah, and she ended up on, I mean, there are 40 people ahead of her now, suddenly. And yet she passed all the physicals. She was in really rigid, you know, very, very disciplined training. Passed all the physical exams, passed the intelligence and all that kind of thing. And then got, you know, sideswiped by the military service thing. And I think that's a really interesting thing about government jobs, that they give this military experience points, even when those people were not in times of war. I mean, it wasn't even a possibility that the woman would be drafted, or that she didn't serve in it.
New Jersey has a class action suit on that in a federal grant that was given. By the way, I think there are also inefficiencies everywhere in men in government, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really bad in government. And that in middle management, we're not finding the same difficulty as being given a job just to fill the quota, and they just put them in a corner. But in their contributions, I think in the high level, that they are certainly succeeding in the government the same as the men.
I was saying that. I mean, that's one place. If women training into government, you know, and really challenging that military service structure, are going to also help many men. My father worked for the federal government for 37 years. He was too young to fight in World War I, too old to
My
fight
dad
in
was
World
too.
War II. And men would come out of retire for 20 years in the service and would come in where he had been working for 20 years and be promoted to a place above him, having absolutely no knowledge of the department or anything like that. You know. So that's going to help if they can fight that battle.
I did the same thing with post job in a small post office. Mm-hmm. You know, I passed everything great, you know, and everything was fine. My civil service was the highest record, and then somebody threw in the military record, and that was, you know, down the tube. So that happens all the time.
Okay, just a couple comments that you might want to make in the relation to the church and the use of women. I think probably we have caused more trouble in suddenly in the church and in theology. There's nowhere I can find where it says that only men are called to be servants of God. Some way or other, it seems to me that no matter what kind of servant is, that he's not selecting out 50% of the population of human beings by virtue of their sex, and that therefore I think we certainly have trouble in examining discrimination in the church. What was it, 1960 something, 68 or 69, before we have our first woman Lutheran minister? One large church body of Lutherans still see it as not quite appropriate. But I think all levels of the church we may have some difficulties. And I thought maybe just for a couple of minutes, if you have any reactions in the church scene.
Well, in our church, the woman still does not have a vote. And I
it must be Missouri Synod.
It is.
There are 11 congregations of the ALC that still don't have women.
And if anything makes me mad, it's me as a working woman, and I'm putting in my money, I'm supporting the church, but still I do not have a vote. I can't understand
that. But this is not gendering.
But in pastoral care, it's generally true in the Lutheran Missouri Synod.
Not voting,
no. In terms of serving as a pastor or administering any of the sacraments.
One argument that I thought was good when discussing the ordination of women in our synod, which just passed, I think, last convention, was that you know, and I think women more than men come up with this idea, well, if women take on these roles, then our men, you know, it's hard enough, the church is 75% women as it is, and if we let
you know, the women, usher, let them do these things, then we're going to have no men in the church and so on. And this woman came up with a statement, do you think that if the men are failing to do their job, that the Lord is going to stop his work on earth? In other words, he'll use the women until the men come along. And I thought that was kind of a good thought, that, you know, if the men are failing, he'll use other means, he'll use the women. And, you know, I think it's going to balance itself out. You know, I think men need liberation as much as women do. But, you know, and the church maybe is behind education and government and everything. I think we're really the last in getting into this, being totally free, male and female. I think we're really role more in the church than you are in these other areas. Do you agree or not?
I agree.
Go ahead.
Oh, I agree. It's incredible. I'm asked to teach Sunday school on the lower levels. I'm asked maybe to take a league group out. Never have I been asked to teach an adult Bible class. Like I'm some kind of a nut. I'd be a nut to do it. But I would like the opportunity to say no. And I also worked in a Missouri synod sort of church. As a matter of fact, I think it's one of the greatest places for males to dominate if they want to. 75% of the women work and 90% of the men run the church in terms of the positions that are the decision-making kinds of positions. The call committee. We had a call committee of 8 people, one of whom was a woman. It seems to me if 75% of the congregation, which it isn't in ours, are women, maybe the women, whether it's a male or a female, ought to have a little more of the decision-making power in it. But I didn't know it until it was well formed, I'll tell you.
I've been to a couple of interesting conferences with Marge Wold, and I think in our church where I belong, the women are the ones that are giving the women the bad time. And the men, if they are reminded of their ignorance, will come a long way, such as in the ALC, the Commission on Abortion didn't have any women on it. And the women went in and said, if you're going to talk about whether we should have abortion or not, how we're going to stand, wouldn't it be nice if we had a woman on the committee? And the men hadn't even noticed that they didn't have a woman on the committee.
But
in the local congregation, that's not the case, because in the local congregation, when we elect our trustees and that, it's the women that exclude the women from the positions in the church that I belong to.
Yeah.
Which to me is the problem whenever I encounter any discrimination or, you know, about what I can do because I'm a female, it comes from another female, it doesn't come from a man.
Yeah.
Well, like most women working in an office do not want a woman office manager.
That's right.
They want to work under
the queen bee syndrome or something.
One time I've known our church president is a woman, and over, I think at least half of our women are on the council, or half of the council members are women. And we, not only that, but just about half of our Sunday school teachers are men.
And do the men still come to church and survive and everything?
I wish opened doors for them.
But you know, it's a small congregation.
Yeah, it probably is.
I live in a parsonage, and I always say, good gravy, if there would have been a woman on those boards when those kitchens were
made. It's so unreal. It's just so unreal, the kitchen I'm living in. And most, you know, and it's just because, you know, and even in the business, building industry, I just think somehow they need to get a lot more women in all these areas. We sure have a lot of good changes. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to have that woman mind in there, too.
I think that all I really wanted to do today is to have us explore a little bit the fact that we are human beings first, and that we need to examine all the kinds of things that happen in our society for the positive, and to get the best of both worlds together, and then in the marriages, in the singlehood, in whatever ways of society, and certainly in the church, that we then ultimately look at what is the very best way to function for all the 100% of the human beings, and it will itself then get rid of the discriminatory sorts of things that can happen.
Can I add one thing?
Sure.
I just want to tell a story.
We got 2 stories before you may leave.
Something really positive that happened to me this fall. I participated in a conference on women and men in church and society in the Tri-Cities, which is just south of here. for bulletin board, and the other participant was the other woman, ALP pastor in the district who's married around in Anchorage, Alaska. And we were down there for about 5 days and doing all kinds of little talky things, which get a little boring. Take number 37, click. But the last day we were there was Reformation Day. Sunday, and they had a big Reformation festival. It's the biggest church in the area, original to the church, and you know, people came from all over the conference, and they were all there, and it was full, and all the clergy came. There were about 16 of them there, and Mary was the preacher, and I was the celebrant. And, you know, a real worship service for men, and most all the men clergy were the deacons for the communion service and stuff like that. But it was a real sense of men and women serving in perfectly equal capacities in the church, and it was so exciting, and that feeling was so good. At the end of the service, all the clergy were back there, just we were screaming, crying, and hugging each other, and everything. And it, because that's just what it was, you know. There was just nothing weird about it, or nothing strange, or nothing new. It was just everybody literally celebrating God's gift of life in Christ Jesus and doing that together, and it was just fun.
My story is how you can sabotage your church council. I'm on the church council. There are three women on the church council, and we were a host for a conference. And so they were at the council meeting. They were divvying up the jobs, and there were three jobs that were traditionally women's jobs. There was registering a guest, and there was serving coffee, and then there was one that was a sign task. It was to represent the congregation on the women's task force, something or other, blah, blah, whatever it was, committee. And so the very first thing that the council president did was he tried to get rid of all the jobs, but he dealt with the women's jobs first. And he named off all the jobs, and there were things like getting the rooms ready, setting up the sound system, doing all these other things. Well, so he posed the question of who's going to bring the coffee and cookies. One of the women volunteered for that.
I
got rid of the registrar job on the other woman, and so then I raised my hand. I said, "I'll be the sound system person." And Joe Hoytstedt, who was sitting next to me, could go to the women's task force. And it so discombobulated the whole meeting that they practically fell over each other. And so finally, I had to go be the representative for the women's task force. But I thought it was kind of fun if Joe Hoytstedt had been the guy that went to the women's task force. Be much more helpful than if I had an idea. And I knew how to do the sound.
My triumph is that at the University of Maryland, I have never served as the secretary to anything, to any committee, to any group since I arrived in 1968. And everybody hates me for it, both men and women, because they don't like the idea. But because of that, other things rotate, and I have become chairman of several things that are important committees. And I think just by virtue of refusal, I can't spell anything. Why ought I be secretary in it? But it was a general principle which gave them at least some thought process of automatically saying Jane is the secretary in a sort of stereotype way.